Okay, we're going to begin with the Mishnah on Kuf Heyam with Aleph. The Mishnah says, "Makabel sadeh mechaveiro, v'lo ratzah lenachesh." Person takes a field to work the field, and he doesn't want to weed the field. Now, if you remember, Rav Papa told us that the first two Mishnayot in the Perek apply both equally to an aris, a sharecropper, and to a choker, and someone who picks fixed amount of produce from the field. But after that point, all the Mishnayot are either true of a choker or true of a kablan, true of a fixed payer or true of a percentage payer. Over here, our Mishnah is only relevant by a choker, by someone who is paying a fixed amount of the field. So he says, he takes the field and he says, she doesn't want to weed it. What do you care? He says, the person who's working the field says to the balabait, what do you care? I'm going to pay you the amount, I'm going to give you the wheat or the production that you deserve, and so why do you care if I leave these weeds in the field? I'm going to give you the amount that we agreed to. He doesn't have a right to do this. Why? The balabait, the owner of the field, can say back to him, afterwards, you're going to leave this field in the future. And the problem is that once you leave the field, this field is going to be full of weeds. So the fact that you're not weeding it in the current year and it affects the crops in the current year, okay, you can say me, you can pay me what you need to pay me. But the fact that you don't weed it has impact in the future. And that we're not going to let you do. Gemara says, "I amalei the butter hachi kriv nala." So the Gemara is continuing off with what the Mishnah said. Okay, what happens if he says to him, "I won't weed, but at the end of the season I'll plow"? If you remember earlier on, right, that they used to plow after the plantings in order to uproot the roots from the bad plants or the weeds in order to clear the field. So he says, "Listen, I won't weed during the year. Instead, I'll just plow through it." He says, I want good quality wheat. If I want good quality wheat, if they're competing with the weeds that are there, they're not going to come out as good quality. So I insist that you weed during the season and not just plow it afterwards. He says to him, listen, don't worry about the good quality wheat. I'll go out into the shuk and I'll buy you wheat. So why do you care if I leave this field fallow and I let the weeds grow? The person can say, we have the concept in many places, that the person says, no, I want wheat from my field. I don't want to get wheat from the shuk. So if he says to them, listen, I'll weed out the amount that I owe you, he means I'll weed around the area that will produce the amount that I owe you. Says, nevertheless, he says, no, you can't just weed that section, you have to weed the entire field, because you're going to give a bad name to my field. My field now is going to be known as a field that is full of weed, or a weedy field, and people are not going to want to either purchase it or not going to want to be choker this field. But doesn't our Mishnah state what the reason that we reject this position of the individual? And he says clearly, because mipnei shamalat lifanai asavim, that the balabait says is because when you leave here, it's going to be left with weeds. So ella mishum damle bizra denafal nafal. Now the reason for all of these, why he can reject him in all these cases, whether he says to him, listen, what do you care? I'll give you the wheat from the field, or what do you care? I'll buy it from the shuk, or what do you care? Right, I'll weed the area that's yours. In all these instances, he can say no to him. Why? Because in the end, if you don't weed now, in the end, that will cause problems in the future. Why will cause problems in the future? Because once a weed has fallen, has rooted in the field, it will reproduce itself. Even if you plow it, even if you take it out later on, the seeds fall again and again, and the weed reappears. So you need to be vigilant and constantly on guard to ensure that weeds don't appear in the field. Because once the weeds get a hold in the field, they won't disappear. And that's the reasoning of the Mishnah, and that explains all the other cases too. That's his basic claim. You can't leave the weeds here because that will have impact on me in the future. Okay, next Mishnah. Hamakabel sadeh mechaviro v'lo asta. That person takes a field from his friend and it doesn't produce. Right now, this case of the Mishnah, again, we have to say it's only by an aris. This is only applicable or only relevant by a sharecropper, because imyesh ba kedei lahamid kri, so the field is not productive, and does he have to work it? Meaning, does he have to continue to work the field? It's not worth his time. The investment of time and effort that he puts in here, is it really worth it to him? So he says, nah, it's not worth it to me anymore. So how much production does it have to be in order to force him to work the field? So the Gemara says, im yesh bagdei lahamid kri, if there's enough to make a pile out of the harvested produce, chayav, the tapel ba, yes, this sharecropper, even though it's not really worth his while, but once it gets up to this amount, meaning that it has the productive capability of producing a kri this year, then we say to him, he's got to harvest the crop and he's got to bring it in so that the Baal Bayit will get his percentage. So Amar Rabbi Yehuda, my kitzva b'kri. Kri is not an objective standard, meaning that how could you use kri as the objective standard? You have big fields, you have small fields. Why should they Why should it be relevant a kri as a standard? Elam yesh ba kedei nefila. Review. This says no. It's the amount that it takes to plant the seeds that you're going to use. Gemara will define all of these items. Tam rabbanan. Amakabel sende mechavero lasta. A person takes a field, a sharecropper, who takes a field, and it's not productive. Im yesh ba kedei lamid kri. If there's enough there to make a pile, chayev letepel ba. He has to work it, even though it may not really be worth his while. Nevertheless, once it reaches this productive capability, the Baal HaBayit can insist that he works the field. Shekach chotevlo, because this is what he writes in the contract that they have. Ana okim vanir. I will go and plow ve'ezra and plant ve'chzod and harvest ve'amer and pile up ve'edosh and I will thresh ve'idre and I will winnow your kim ve'ukim karya kadamach and I will place a pile before you. So that fact that he has to place a pile before him, if there's enough to place a pile, then he can fulfill the contractual obligations, and therefore will demand of him to do that. V'tete ant, and you will come, v'titol palka, and you'll take 50% of it. V'ana ba'maliv, nafkut yadai, and me, for my efforts, my work, and my expenditures, palka, I'll get the other half. Bekama, so how much is it? How much does it have to be in order to force him to work? Kedei, lamid bakri, so enough to make a pile. No, it's not just how much you make a pile, but what does it mean, a pile? A pile is enough where you can stick the pitchfork into it and it will stand. So the way Rashi learns this means that if you put a pitchfork in there, but the sides of the pitchfork are visible when you plant it into the pile, is that enough of a pile? The way the Grach learns it is, which way are you putting the pitchfork into the pile? Are you putting it in with the fork down, or are you putting it in with the handle? If you put it with the fork down, then the fork is big, and it will be supported inside the pile, and it takes less of a pile. Whereas if you're going to put the handle into the pile, and the weight will be sitting on top, it'll take a much bigger pile to hold up the pitchfork. Because the Rach's girsa is, mehai gisa, o mehai gisa, from this side or that side, meaning which side of the pitchfork. Tashma, amra bo, lididima, fashali meinei, the Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina. I heard the explanation of what Rabbi Yossi Mechin says, kol she'in koneh shelo ro'ed pnei achama. As long as its fork doesn't see the sun. So according to Rashi, the answer is, if it sticks out on the sides of the pile when you put the pitchfork in, that's no good, because the pile has to cover the entire fork of the pitchfork. And according to Rabbeinu Hananel, we answered the question, well, which side of the pitchfork must be in the pile? The answer is the fork of it has to be inside of the pile, because in Ikonishalo, as long as the fork itself doesn't see the sun, meaning that the fork is buried, that's the side that goes into the pile. And again, that would require a smaller pile to hold it up. Itmar. Levi Amar, Levi comes to define for us how big is this pile that you need. Shalosh Seim, it's a pile of three sa'ah. Debei Rabbi Yani Amar Sataim. Debei Rabbi Yani says two sa'ah. Amar Resh Lakish, Lakish says, and we've seen this before, Sataim Shamru, Chutz Min Hotza'ah. We said the Sataim is sufficient in order to demand of him to work the field. If it has productive capability of producing a Sataim, then he has to go and work the field. That Sataim is not simply the harvest that he brings in, he produces Sataim, but it has to be production of Sataim after his expenditures on the field. I mean, it has to be the profit. It has to have a profit or a net of Sataim in order to work. Now, the Gemara is going to continue here, and the only common theme between all the items that are coming up now is the fact that Debei Rabbi Yanai defines what the something in the Mishnah or something in the Braisa. So over here in our case, we had Debei Rabbi Yanai defining for us what's a kri. And Rabbi Yanai says Sataim, right? That means two sa'ah worth, right? So now we have a new Mishnah. It's not Hatam. We have a mission over there. Pritzei zeitim va'anavim. These are the bad olives and grapes. Bad olives and grapes are ones that do not ripen. Beit Shammai mitamim u'Beit Hillel mitarim. Beit Shammai says they are ochel. They're classified as an ochel, and therefore they can be mekabel tuma. Beit Hillel says they're tahor, that they cannot be mekabel tuma. My pritzei zeitim. What are these pritzei zeitim? I mean, I told you already what they are, but now the Gemara says, what are these? Amar Rav Huna, rishei zeitim. These are the bad olives. I mean, the bad olives are what classified as pritzei zeitim. So the Gemara wants to know, where do you know that fact from? Where do you know that these are classified as the pritzei zeitim means the bad olives? So Amar Yosef Maikra, we learn it from the Pasuk in Daniel. It says, uvnei pritzei amecha. Here it's talking about the king of the south will rise up, and then there will be those lawless individuals that will join together, lamid chazon, to establish the dream v'nechshalu, and they will trip and they will stumble. So over here, when Bnei Pritze is talking, Paritze, Amcha is talking about those that are lawless, right? The unsavory characters of the nation, and therefore the Pritzim also over here are the no good olives. Rav Nachman Abba Yitzchak Amar Hacha, he brings a pasuk from Yechezkel. We actually quoted this parak earlier on because the first part before is talking about the av, a person who does good. One of the people who does good is a person who doesn't lend out his money with interest. And then in the second part of this parak, it talks about the son, right, the derivative of this individual does good, and he'll have, Olid ben Paritz, he'll have a son who is a Paritz, Shofech Dam, that kills and spills blood. So here you see ben Paritz again is someone who is evil, and there's so these Zeitim here, our Pritzei Zeitim, are negative, it's a negative connotation. Just as a side note over here, this Pasuk in Daniel that's quoted here by the Gemara, Uvnei Paritzei Amcha Yinasu Lamit Chazom Nichshalu, the Rambam actually quotes this in Hilchot Melachim. Rambam quotes this in Hilchot Melachim in Perek Yud Aleph. Not all Rambams would have it because some of them were edited or redacted to remove this item because obviously it was offensive to some of the censors. But I'll just read you the two halachot that are found in the Rambam with regards where he quotes this pasuk here. In Hilchot Melachim, Perek Yud Aleph, the Rambam is talking about Mashiach. What are the qualifications to be the Mashiach and what are the expectations of someone who is the Mashiach? So over here in this part of the Rambam, he quotes, Af Yeshua HaNotzri. Right, so there is a leader of the religion, Shedima Shiye Mashiach, that he claimed to be the Messiah. V'nerag v'beitin, and he was killed in a beitin, Kvar nitadma bebo Daniel. Daniel already had a nevuah about such an individual who will rise up, claim that he is the Mashiach, and then he'll be killed. Shenemar, because it says, this is the pasuk he quotes from Daniel, that is in our Gemara over here, B'nei Paritzei Amcha, yinasu l'amid chazon, they will try to establish a dream, v'nichshalu, and they will stumble, it won't work. Is there a greater stumbling block than what this individual did? That all the Rishonim, all the Nevi'im speak about the fact that what's the purpose of Mashiach? He's going to come and redeem the Jews and save them. And he'll bring about the Kibbutz Galiot to bring them all together. And he'll uphold the Torah and ensure that the mitzvot are kept. This individual claimed to be the Messiah. Garam la Beit Yisrael b'cherev. He caused Jews to be destroyed by the sword. Ulufazer shiritam, to have them burst over the nations. Ulhashpilam, and to demean them. Ulachlifa Torah, and he rejected the Torah. Ulhatot rov haolam lavod elokam milamadei Hashem, and have people go after a god that's not Hashem. So how could you claim that? How can this person claim that he is the Mashiach? It's clear that he's not the Mashiach because he didn't carry out what all the Nevi'im claimed the Mashiach must do. And number two is, he is the Pasuk in Daniel. The Rambam says is referring to this individual because it says over there that he will try to establish a chazon, a dream, or a prophecy about the fact that the Mashiach is here, v'nichshalu, and they will stumble. And the Rambam says the stumbling is the fact that he does the exact opposite of what the Mashiach is supposed to do. Aval, that's amazing what the Rambam says afterwards, machshavot barwei olam. Aim koach ba'adam la'sigam. People cannot understand the ways of God. Ki lo darcheinu derachav, lo machshavatenu machshavotav. Our ways and our thoughts are not those of God. B'chol dvarim ha'elu shel Yeshua notzri. Right, the, all of these of this Messiah. V'shel hazeh ha'ishmaili. And also the prophet of the Muslims. She'amad achra, that came afterwards, that established the two major religions of the world today. Enam ele yasher derach le'melech ha'mashiach. They are the preparatory stage, right, for Mashiach to come. In order to prepare the whole world to worship together or a singular God. So Rambam claims that these two religions at least established among the people monotheism and a pathway by which in the end we can all come to worship the same God. I just bring it down as a sidebar and importantly, because the pasuk that the Rambam quotes for this issue, he is mentioned here in our Gemara, but here it's brought to tell us why paritz means someone who is a rasha, and in our Gemara, paritz means the bad olives. So in this case, the Gemara says, okay, bekama pritzei zeitim. How do you classify something as being pritzei zeitim? Lazarmar arbat karbim lekorah. It has to do with production. I can tell you how ripe the grapes have to be to not be considered as bad grapes, or how unripe they have to be to classify it as pritzei zeitim. So it says, well, if you put it under the korah is the board that they use to press the olives. So if you take a full board's worth of olives and it only produces 4 kav, and from that there's only a production of 4 kav, then that's classified as pritzei zeitim. Debe Rabbi Yana Amre, so this is the common theme why this is brought an argument over here. Sataim le Korah, that he has to produce two sa'ah for the Korah, meaning that they place under the Korah the beam and to press it, then if it produces two sa'ah worth of oil, then that is classified as being, or if it produces under that amount, that'll be classified as being Rishei Zeitim. Below Pligi, they don't argue, but Rabbi Anai and Rabbi Lazar, Haba Atra Demaile Kura Ba'olala, Haba Atra Demaile Tlata Kurin Ba'olala, depends on the press. In the area or the city of Rabbi Elazar, they only used to put a core worth of zeitim, of olives, into the press or under the beam, and therefore the requirement was 4 kav, production of 4 kav. On the other hand, in the place of Bei Rabbi Anai, they used to put under 3 core worth of olives under the press, under the board, and therefore his requirement is sataim, sa'atu sa'ah. And that's because each sa'ah is 6 kav. So now, if you put in 1 core for Rabbi Elazar, and Bei Rabbi Anai puts in 3 core, that means that we have 3 times the amount of olives that are found here. So if Rabbi Elazar requires 4 kav, 3 times 4 kav is 12 kav. And if each sa'ah is 6 kav, that means 2 sa'ah is the production that you need in order to be classified, or that amount or less will be classified as Rishei or Pritzei Zeitim, as being olives that are not ripe, and therefore, according to Beit Hillel, they would not be Mekabel Tumat Ochlim. Right now, we have another statement, another Mishnah, and again, the reason it's brought here is because Bei Rabbi Anai, Tan Rabbanan, Alu Ibilan. Two individuals went up into a tree, Shekocho Ra, that was weak. Ubsukah shekochol ra, or into a sukkah that was kochol ra. Sukkah here is not a sukkah like we know, meaning that the sukkah of the chag, but sukkah here, as Rashi points out, is an anaf ilan, the branch of the tree, because it's misachich, that it creates shade. So in this case, a person who was tahor went onto or shared onto a similar branch or tree as a zav, someone that was tamei. So now they're both on it, but the branch that he went onto or the tree that he went on weren't so sturdy. So what's the case over here? So this happens to be Machloch Tarishonim. I had explained this Mishnah in Zavin. The way Rashi learns it, and he quotes over here, the problem here is Tumat Midras. We're worried about Tumat Midras because this is the first part of the Mishnah that this is quoted from. This is the second half of the Mishnah. The first part of the Mishnah mentions these items as being Tumat Midras in a boat. A Zav and a Tahor that are in a boat, then the Tahors, Tamei Tumat Midras, because they are in the same boat. Why are they Tamei Tumat Midras? Because in the boat, it has to be, since the boat rocks and moves back and forth, there's no way that the weight of the Zav didn't impact where the Tahor was sitting. And also, the possibility is if the boat is rocking, that they would come into contact with each other. There's a possibility that they might have touched each other and come into contact with each other. That's the way Rashi learns it. That's the first part of that Mishnah. And Rashi says this part of the Mishnah, the second half of the Mishnah Zavin, is also for that same reason. Most of the other Rishonim, including the Mishnah Achrona, the Rambam, the Rosh, learn that the problem over here is Tumat Heset, which seems to make sense because the Mishnah is divided into 2 parts. If it was all the same reason, then this should be included in the first part of the Mishnah. So now you have a second part of the Mishnah. The Mishnah says the problem here is Tumat Heset. Tumat Heset is that if by moving an object you cause another individual to be moved, the Tumat is passed through what's called Tumat Heset, Tumat of shaking. So over here, the case of the Zav and the Tahor being on the branch, according to Rashi, the fact that they're on a weak branch or a weak tree means that the weight of one individual will cause the other one to go up or go down. So that will be the midras, or because it's unsteady or it's not sturdy, they will come possibly to touch each other. And according to the other Rishonim, the problem here is when they're on this weak branch or this weak tree, the movement of the Zav will be felt by the Tahor individual that's there, and therefore he'll be Tamei Tumat Heset. So the Machlokas here is whether this is Tumat Heset or Tumat Midras. Again, that's relevant to the Mishnah and Zavim, just giving the background to the Mishnah. Now, Amrei de Rabbi Anai. So the Gemara wants to know, Echidami Ilan Shekochol Ra. What does it mean that it's a non-sturdy tree? How do you determine if a tree is sturdy or not? So Amrei to Bei Rabbi Anai. Again, this is why it's found in argument here. Kol Shein Bikaro L'Chok Rova. That if it doesn't have in its trunk enough to carve in a Rova Hakav, then that will not be a sturdy tree. I mean, the thickness of the trunk has to give one the ability to carve out a Rova Hakav. If it doesn't have that thickness, then it's a weak tree. Hechidami Suko Shekochora. How do you have a branch that is weak? How do you classify a branch that's weak? Amareish Lakish Kol Shenechbat Bechezyona. Anything that if you put your hand around it, if your hand can encompass the entire branch, meaning that if you put your hand there, the fingers will reach your palm on the other side. In that case, that is considered thin, narrow, and weak. Whereas if your hand cannot reach around it, then it's thick enough that it will not be considered as or classified as being a weak branch. Tosus leaves his atema here. He says he doesn't see why this is relevant. He says that you can, even with a branch that's thick, they could still be movement, or there could be tumataseit, because movement is not necessarily it has to break or shake, meaning the fact that it moves, even thicker branches we see, when you can't get your hand around it, they still move. So he doesn't know why this should be the qualification in this instance. It's not hatam. We have a Mishnah in Olot. Amalech v'beit ha'pras, someone who goes in beit ha'pras. Beit ha'pras, we've seen this many times in Shas, is a field in which there was a kever that was lost and the field was plowed over. So the underlying assumption of the chachamim, the field technically midoraisa is tahor. But the chachamim imposed tumah on this field. Why? Because what are we choshesh? We worry about the fact that when they plowed around, they moved the bones of whatever kever was there, whatever grave that was there, they plowed it around. Now, so we're tumat Ohel, we no longer worry about that, because Tumat Ohel requires that you have Rov Binyan or Rov Minyan. You have to have the majority of the bones or the majority of the build of the individual to be there. But now it's plowed around. We assume that the bones cracked and got dispersed, so there will be no Tumat Ohel. What we do worry about is Tumat Maga and Masa. What we worry about is that you have Tumat Maga, is that if you come into contact with the ground, there will be a little piece of a bone that you will touch. You become Tumei Mate, because Tumat Maga only requires Etzem Kise Ora, Etzem the size of a barley seed, a bone the size of a barley seed, or you'll have tumat, we'll call it masar haseit, that you'll come in, you'll somehow move a bone, or you'll carry a bone by walking along the path here. So that's what we fear. So this is the case here. Amalech beit ha'pras, agabe avanim, someone who goes through this field, and he wants to be tahor afterwards. If he walks on the stones that are there, sheyachol haseit, right, if they are stones that move, right, that they're not secure in the ground, or al hadam, on a person, Val Behema, or an animal, he rides a person on the shoulders of a person or on the back of an animal, Shukochanra, who are not strong, Tameh. In all of these cases, he is Tameh. Because what is our fear, what is our problem over here, is that when he's going along this field, the movement of the rocks will cause, he will cause, by through stepping on the rock, that movement of the rock will touch a bone and move the bone, and therefore he'll be Tameh, Tum'at Mate, because of the movement of the rock that moved the bone or came into contact with the bone. The same thing with this behema, this individual, if they are not strong and they are not able to carry him in a secure way, then his movement or his shifting or their riding under him will affect the tumah. It's clear that the individual who's carrying him and touching, walking on the ground is tameh. The only question here is that once he is tameh, right, does he affect the individual that is above him? So if he is weak and he's unable to carry the individual strongly, then we assume that the weight or the movement of the upper individual affects the lower individual. It's as if he himself moved the item or the bone that's on the ground and he'll become tameh. Tosus asks the question over here, why should it matter whether he moves him or not? Even if it's a strong person, you have too much should pass from the individual below to the original above, either because of tumat chiburim or because of tumah will pass from the lower individual. So Tosus has to come up with the hechitimsa, where that the tumah will not pass where the lower individual is wearing a lot of clothing or there's some sort of separation which doesn't allow the tumah to pass, and only if he's a weak individual will it cause the movement of the item below. So Gemara says, hechidomi adam shekochura. How do we determine that what is called a person who is weak? Any person who, when you're riding on his shoulders, the weight of the individual on top or the strain from the person on top causes the lower individual's knees to knock one against the other, meaning that there's so much burden that he's weakened by the weight, or he is weak and he can't carry this weight, and therefore his knees knock together, and his knees knocking together is an indication of him being weak, and therefore the upper individual shifting or moving will affect the lower individual in that sense. I think you could have said, although I didn't see this explanation, that it means that the upper rider's knees are bumping together, meaning that the lower individual is swaying so much that the knees of the upper individual are banging together. Hechidami behema shekocha ra. How do we define an animal who is weak? Amrei de Bei Rabbi Yanai, again, this is why it's found in our Gemaras, De Bei Rabbi Yanai, Kosher Rochva Matila Galalim. Every time you ride it, it automatically relieves itself. So the fact, the strain of being riding on it causes it to relieve itself, then you know this animal is a weak animal. So now, Amrei de Bei Rabbi Yanai, another statement now independently of De Bei Rabbi Yanai, the Tfilah Tfilin Dalet Kabin. When it comes to davening and tfilin, there's a din of Dalet Kabin. So the tefillah ma'ahi, what does it mean by tefillah? Adetanya, anosim masui al ktefo, someone who's carrying a burden on his shoulders, ve'giyaz man tefillah, and it's time to daven. Pachot midalik kabim, if the burden that he's carrying, the load that he's carrying is less than 4 kav, then he can throw them over his shoulder, mashilan la'achurav, he can throw them off his back, and he can just continue, you can can keep the burden because it's not so heavy that it's distracting for him to daven with it. It's considered to be a normal load, and therefore he can daven with this item on him. On the other hand, if it's greater than that, arba kavim, meniach agabi karko mitzvah, if it reaches four kav or greater, then the burden is in excess of what we considered a de minimis amount or an insignificant amount, and therefore he would have to unload himself. He'd have to put the burden or the what he's carrying down before he davens. So that's the Dalet Kabin by Tfilah of the Bei Rabbi Yanai. Lit Tfilin Mahi. What's the din by Tfilin that is affected by the Dalet Kabin? The Tanya, Hayan Nosem Masuya or Rosho. If he was carrying something on his head, he was carrying a burden on his head. U Tfilin Birosho, and he has Tfilin on his head. Imayu Tfilin Rotzot Asur. If the burden on his head crushes or presses down on the Tfilin, he cannot wear the Tfilin. Bimlav, if the burden on top does not affect his tefillin, then mutar, he can wear tefillin. Bezu masui amru. So what is the masui? How do we know whether the masui is pressing on the tefillin or not pressing on the tefillin? So masui shabat kabin. So that's the answer again. The arba kabin here is defining what load a person has on his head, which will invalidate him or make it a sur for him to wear tefillin, and that's four kavin. Under four kavin, we assume that he can wear his tefillin, it won't press on the tefillin, it won't crush the tefillin. And then if it's more than four kavin, we said that it's inappropriate for him to wear tefillin. Tani Rabbi Chia. Someone who was carrying dung out on his head, he's carrying a burden, he's carrying dung on his head, then with tefillin b'sho, and he has tefillin on his head. So then, obviously, it's inappropriate that he has dung on his head and his tefillin on his head, so you can't have both. So harizeh lo yisal kem l'tzadim, so what should he do with the tefillin? He has to remove the tefillin because he's carrying the zevel. He shouldn't just move them to the side. That's not appropriate. V'lo yikshirim b'mot. No, he shouldn't tie them around his waist. B'neishu neg behen minhag bizayon. Because this is a bizayon to the tefillin. This isn't the proper way to conduct oneself when it comes to tefillin or to carry tefillin in this way. Ella, what should you do with your tefillin shel rosh? Kushran al zro'o b'mokom tefillin. You should tie them onto your arm where your tefillin shel yad are. So you place them in the same location as where the tefillin shel yad are. And you tie them around your arm because that is not a derech bizayon. Now, mishum de beishila amru. From the base measure of Shila, they said, "Afilu mitpachat shelhen asur." Now here the gear says unclear what the gear says. Rashi says mitpachat shelhen means the handkerchief that you put the tefillin into shelhen. The Rach has a gear says mitpachat plain, but means mitpachat shelechem, means like a handkerchief or a cloth that they used to put the bread in. Either way, it's a very small item, very light item that even if that is put on the head, asur laniach al rosh sheish bo tefillin. You can't place that simultaneously on your head if you have tefillin on. Meaning the Beit Rav Shila says basically that you can't put anything on your head when you have tefillin on. The camel, how much is this? How much is his weight? I'm Rabbi, I feel the riva de riva de pumptita. It's even a quarter of a liter. That's what Rashi says, a quarter of riva de liter de bar muatu. It's a quarter of a liter of pumptita, which is a very, very small amount. I mean, anything significant. Obviously, we wear a yarmulke on your head when you have tefillin on, that's okay. But anything that seems any has any amount of significance, then would be, according to Beit Rav Shila, would be asur, would be restricted from being on your head at the same time that you have tefillin on. Now the Gemara comes back to the second part of the Mishnah. Now we discussed in the Mishnah, right, the fact that how much production must the field have in order to demand of the arista sharecropper to work it, and that according to the Tanakhama we said was a kri, the amount of a pile. So then Rabbi Yehuda says kri is not a defined amount. Kri can be, if you have a big field, small field, it will make a difference. So Rabbi Yehuda says no, it has to do with kedei nefila. It has to be amount that you plant. So v'kama k'dei nefila, how much is the amount? What type of production or what type amount of seeds do you need in order to plant? So Rabbi Ami Amar, Rabbi Yochanan, arba'a sa'in l'kur. Rabbi Ami Dilei Amar, shmonat sa'im l'kur. So the way we have our girsa in a Gemara, and this is the way Tosfos' girsa was that it was four sa'ah for every kur. For every beit kur, you have to, if it produces four sa'ah worth, meaning that either it produces four sa'ah worth, or if you take, normally if you planted four sa'ah in a beit kur, it would produce a kur worth of tefuah. So in that case, that level of production is enough to demand of him to work it. So it's four sa'ah to the kur. And Rabbi Ami Dilei Amar shmonat sa'im l'kur. It's eight sa'ah to the kur being 30 sa'ah. So according to Rabbi Yochanan, it'd be four out of 30. And according to Rabbi Ami, it'd be 8 out of 30. So Amar Leihau Sabo de Rav Chama Brei de Rabba Baravua. So this other individual said to Rav Chama Brei de Rabba Baravua, I'll explain to you why they're not arguing. Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Ami, who is the Talmud of Rabbi Yochanan, I'll show you that Rabbi Ami is not arguing with his Rebbe, Rabbi Yochanan. Why? B'shnei de Rabbi Yochanan of Shmei Na'ara. In the days of Rabbi Yochanan, the land was very fertile and very productive, and therefore it only required four sa'ah to produce a core's worth. The same thing, if you planted a core and you got four sa'as out of it, then it's worthwhile because then you can use that to plant a following core. B'shnei de Rabbi Ami, in the time of Rabbi Ami, have a k'chisha ara, the land was not as fertile, was not as productive, and therefore they needed eight sa'ah to get a core, to produce a core, and also you only if you get eight sa'ah out of a field that should have produced a core, is it worthwhile to harvest, because then you can replant it to produce a core. So now it's not hatam. We have a mission over there. Haruach shepizra et omrim, omdim ota kama leket ruuya la'asot. If the wind came and the piles that are out in the field that he's supposed to give leket to the aniyim from, then they get blown away. So how does he now assess, right, how much he owes to the aniyim? Because now the piles are gone and we don't know how much he owes. So now, what do we do? Omdim ota kama leket ruuya la'asot. We look at how much leket this field should produce. V'notein l'aniyim, and then we give it to aniyim. Rabbi Shimon Omer, notein l'aniyim k'dei nifila. Shimon Omer says, no, we give the amount of seeding we give to the aniyim. V'kama k'dei nifila. So this is the same question that we have in our Mishnah, k'dei nifila. Ki'at ravdim yam rabbi Elazar v'item rabbi Yochanan arba'at kabim l'kur. It's four kav to a kur. So according to Tosfos, the original, the girsa above was four sa'a to a kor, and over here our gears is four kav into a kor, and that'll be the difference between them. That'll be the difference between, we'll see in a second, the Gemara is going to differentiate between tvu'a and to zera. So when we were speaking above, we were speaking if you harvested a kor worth of tvu'a, a kor worth of production on the field, then out of that kor you have to at least get four or eight, right, sa'a, according to Tosfos, in order that will produce seeds that can be planted to produce enough for a bait kor, and again, enough to be sufficient that it will demand of you to work the field. Whereas over here, we're talking about a kor of zera. It's not any longer the tvu'a, it's not the production, the field, the wheat that you've harvested off the field, but rather it's now the seeds themselves. You have a kor of seeds. When you have a kor of seeds, then you only need arba kavin, four kav out of that amount, because again, that would be 1/6 of the amount against four sa'ah, because here it's pure seeds. So then you only need four kav to plant versus four sa'in. On the other hand, the gra equates the two girsa'ot and says that both girsa'ot are arba kabim l'kur. Then we're not talking about everything here is four kav to a kur, and that brings on then the Gemara's next question. By Rabbi Yirmiyah, the kur zera or the kur tvua? When we say a kur to a, when we say the kur over here, say four kav to a kur, or four sa'at to a kur, according to Tosfos, and whereas according to the Grat, the question is now, in both of these cases, the four kav to a kur, what does that mean? Is that the kur zera or the kur tvua? Is that a kur worth of seed, meaning producing a kur's worth of seed, or is that meaning producing a kur's worth of production, which is a wheat that you produce out of the field? Wheat stalks was a kur's worth of production. The mapolet yad, when you're seeding over here, when we're talking about seeding, we're talking about hand seeding. Or the mapolet shvarim, are we talking about using a seeder, meaning that here the oxen would pull a bucket on wheels that had a hole in it, and then as they're plowing along, the seeds would fall into the ground. So again, you would need many more seeds when it comes to mapolet shvarim if you're going to use this device that plants the cedar versus if you do it by hand. And number two is, it will be, if you have a kur of zera, you need less because it's pure seeds, versus a kur of tva, which has to be processed in order to get to the seed. So there you would need more. So Gemara says, Tashma, Dichata Rav Amar Rav Amar Rav Elazar, Amri Lo Amar Rav Yochanan, Arbat Kabim Lekur Zera. It's four kav to a kur zera. So again, according to Tosfos, we're just addressing the case over here by Leket, which is there, it's four kav to kur zera, whereas what we were speaking up above was arba sa'im l'kur, which would be probably for kur tvu'ah, that's what it sounds like. And according to the Gra, this is an answer for both cases. Both cases are arbat kabin l'kur zera, kur, and that kur is a kur of zera. We still have the remaining question is how much is this, you know, how much do we need in order to to plant a kor's worth? Is this for hand planting or planting through a cedar? Teku, that we don't know. So we don't know if that what it means when we're looking at a bait kor, how much production that you need. When this production comes off the field, meaning now we know it's arba kabin, four kav of seeds that had come out of this field. If you can get four kav worth of seeds out of this field, then we say you have to work the field. But again, we don't know if that four kav is enough seed to plant by hand, or is that enough seed to plant by using the cedar. Okay, so now the Gemara continues with the new Mishnah. Hamakabel sadeh mechavero, v'chlach agav, unishtafa. So again, here, this Mishnah is only going to apply to a choker, someone who pays a fixed amount of the field's production each year. Because if it's a percentage, then the person doesn't lose anything here. If the field's not productive, then he loses and the Baal HaBayit loses because he only pays him a percentage of whatever's made. Whereas if you pay a fixed amount per year, then if the field doesn't produce, then you're giving up the whole production because you're giving a fixed amount. There's no diminishment of the payment that you are making. So therefore, a person who takes a field from his ben vachlach agav, it was eaten by locusts, or was dried out, if it's something that affected the entire area, so that we have to see. Rashi, we'll see in the Gemara in a second, what does it mean, makat medina? He can take down the fixed amount that he's paying him, he can reduce it. If it's not something that affected the whole area, then we can say it's your bad mazel. It's your bad mazel. You got to pay what you agreed to pay, and I'm sorry that it didn't work out for you. If he agreed to pay him money, not production from the field, whether it's a, here it means a fixed production from the fixed amount of the production from the field, but rather he says, I'll give you a monetary amount, then he doesn't diminish the amount that he has to pay because money is not affected by any of these issues. So the fact that they agreed in money and something bad happened, that's his problem, that's his bad mazel that something like this happened. I just want to recall over here that remember we had the Tosfos that we mentioned earlier that said this Mishnah clearly says that when it comes to Chakirut, when it comes to a fixed amount, then you get a deduction in your amount when there's a Makah that affects everybody. So Tosfos asked previously, and we saw this Tosfos together, right? Why is it in the previous Mishnayot, right, Beit HaShlachim, that had a Mayan, had a spring in it, and the spring disappears, then over there we said that applies equally to a Chakir and to a Kablan, even to an Aris, even to a sharecropper. But Tosfos says, from this Mishnah we can see that this has only application, reducing the amount you pay, has only to do with the Choker and not to do with a Kablan. How come the Mishnah earlier allowed this to apply also to a Kablan? So Tosfos earlier on answered that the difference over there is that since he specified in the previous Mishnah something that he wasn't necessarily entitled to or should have gotten, like he says, I want the field with the Mayan, the spring in it, then it's clear that what he's paying, what is his relationship with this individual or the percentage that they set was based on the field with a Mayan. The Mayan disappears, now you're going to have to change the percentage. As opposed to over here, we're talking about Shidafon, and we're talking about plagues or floods that affect everybody, and he can't say that his pricing anticipated only a normal year and not when these unanticipated factors would come in, because this was an inconsistent consideration of his original pricing. When people price, there are these unusual circumstances that come out, but that's not something that is worth changing the pricing for, because that's part of normal pricing. Pricing includes normal years plus these unusual years, and therefore he doesn't have a right now to go back and renegotiate the rate that they set. So Gemara says, Hei chidami makat medina. What is makat medina? So I'm Rav Yehuda, going to ishtuf ruva de bago, as if they've dried out. But according to Rashi, it means rova bika, the rova of that area, that valley or that area of fields, that the rove of that area is dried out, that's considered a makat medina. On the other hand, the Rambam seems to say that means rova sadot ba'ir, meaning the majority of fields in that city, in order to be classified as a makat medina. If the four fields around it, surrounding this field, are also dried out, then that is classified as a makat medina. So from all sides, it had the same thing happened to the fields around it, then that's classified as a makat medina. Amar ula, bobe marovo, they asked the Eretz Yisrael, Nishtav telemechad al pnei kula mai. What happens if this dryness appears around the four fields that are surrounding it? The first row of each of those fields also were affected by that dryness. Or the other way around, that's the din then. And nishtav telemechad al pnei kula. What happens if there's one row all the way around it that separates between it and the other fields? The other fields also dried out, but there's one row that wasn't affected all around this field. Mahu. What is the din over here? So in both of these instances, what's the din? How exact does it have to be? When we say makat, that the four areas to be considered makat medina, the four fields around him have to be affected, it has to mean literally the fields that are adjacent all the way up to him have to be affected right on him at that edge. And then how much of those fields have to be affected? If they're just slightly affected and it's all around him, that's fine, or it has to be the entire field. And second of all, if there's anything that's in between them or something that is mafsik between them, what's the din? Is that considered to be that his field surrounded by the same problem? If what happens if the fields around him weren't planted? So therefore, they weren't going to be affected by the makat medina because they weren't planted. So my, what's the din there? Because do we classify it because they're empty and they're not affected, so then he doesn't get any right? Or do we say, no, had they been planted, they would have been affected, and therefore he has rights here? Same thing with a safstata. What if they planted the fields around him? They didn't plant it with grains like he did, but they planted it with tevin or kash, stuff that they were trying to produce animal feed over there. My, what's the din? I mean, is that because they weren't affected, because they were a different type of production? Or do we say, and if they had been wheat, or had they been the same production that he was doing, they would have been affected? Or do we say, no, too bad, the fields around you are fine, that means that it's not classified as a makat medina? Also, zera acher might. What is it, what's the din if you say that a safsata, if you say that it's this grass or whatever they're growing for the hay, for the animals to eat, if that's not classified as a hefsek, and therefore it would be classified as if his field is surrounded by the problem, what happens if there's another crop? Maybe we can say there, the fact that they weren't affected shows that this is particular to the field and not makat medina. Or do we say, since it's a different grain, then he can say, look, if he had planted wheat like I did, then what would have happened? But now that you planted something else, that's why it was protected. And the last one is, chite legabi sarim kezer acher dami olo. So again, also, what's the din when it comes to chita and seora? I mean, as before, we asked the question about a different crop. Over here, what happens if the crops are different? They're different in the fact that it's wheat and barley, but they're still within the same classification or category of being grains, right? Is that kezer acher dami olo? If it's not, I mean, that if you say there's a problem with, or it's not a problem when there's another item planted around, how different does that item have to be? If it's simply wheat and barley, is that enough if the fields around them are not affected? Or does it have to be, right, something significant difference between them in order to not consider it a hefsek? Kol ha'olam kulo b'shitafon. Everybody else has dryness of their crops. They were blown away. V'shelo b'yirakon, and his withered. Inami kol ha'olam kulo b'yirakon. Everybody else is withered. V'shelo b'shitafon, and his dried out. My, what's the din over there? Teku. In all these cases, we don't have an answer, as according to the definition that Ula gave over here, that has to be the four sedot around. All these different questions remain as a teku. We don't have an answer to them. Okay, we'll stop over here.